Book of Habakkuk, take your notes and turn to page 178. Pages 180 and 81 are available. They are notes on Zephaniah, which I hope we will be able to begin Zephaniah next week. Been interesting to watch the number of people walking in yawning this morning. It must have been a good night for sleep last night, or what was on the late show? I don't know. Habakkuk, turn to page 178, the second principle in the study of Habakkuk. We've noticed already, of course, that the message of Habakkuk is unique. The format of the book is highly unique in the way that we have Habakkuk presenting his message, that Habakkuk is seen in his prayer closet, not in a pulpit preaching, but we hear him in a dialogue with God. And Habakkuk is wrestling with two problems, but I think probably really just one, but they are two dimensions of one problem. And these are questions which you see in chapter 1 and verse 2, and then in chapter 1 and verse 12. And those two questions form the basis for everything else that's developed in the book. And we find Habakkuk talking with God about the age-old question, why do the righteous suffer and the wicked prosper? That why does God allow his own to go through the aggravations and irritations of pressure and suffering in this life, while the wicked apparently continue to prosper and have their own way? And he asked that question in view of two things. One, the moral corruption within his own nation, that Judah had passed the point of survival, and that God was preparing a nation to prepare to bring upon them judgment. And this judgment will come in 586. It will come in terms of the Chaldean invasion of Judea and Jerusalem. And Habakkuk is struggling with the fact that Judah, his corruption, is in a state of total corruption. There is moral, political, spiritual apostasy. And he asks a question, then how long can the Lord, why does the Lord tolerate this? The Lord answers that he is doing a work, and the work is that he is raising up a nation that he will use as a rod to discipline his people. And that nation is Chaldea, the Babylonians. And then that brings a second question to the mind of Habakkuk. How can a nation which acts as a law unto itself, a wicked nation, even more wicked than Judah, a nation which does not even in name honor God, the God of Israel, as their God, a nation which does not even have a covenant relationship with God, how could God use a nation to discipline a nation that is closer to the Lord as far as his covenant plan is concerned? So those two questions then come back to the one question, why does God allow us to suffer? And that big question of why in life. We've asked it on a personal level, and I'm sure we've probably asked it on a national level. We're going to pursue that question on the second principle, study Habakkuk, by relating its message to the book of Job and the problem of human suffering. Before we do that, though, let us pray and commit our day to the Lord and the times that we have to study the Word, that we'll be completely receptive to God's Word for us. Let's pray. Now, Father, I ask that in view of the varied conditions, there are those who come into this service eager, anticipating your word and what you have to say. Undoubtedly, there are some others who at this time are particularly distracted, perhaps distracted by some difficulty at home, perhaps some problem at work, something that's come along recently so that now their mind is distracted and they are having a difficult time with orientation to your plan. And I ask, Lord, that each of us now, as we have this time where we isolate ourselves from a routine, we come to this place in fellowship with one another, that we will, in hearing the word, that we will find that which is food for our soul, It is that which you've designed to satisfy our spiritual thirst. And Lord, it's asked also that we shall find in our time together today the mutual support, concern, and prayer for one another and the worship of you that will mark this day as pleasing to you and that which will carry out your purposes for us. Do that for us in Christ's name. Amen. All right, let's carry on with the second principle then. The paragraph reads as follows. The crisis of Habakkuk is within the book. Note that the Holy Spirit does not draw our attention to the historical circumstances, 1 and 2, though I should quickly say that though we are not given a time reference here, no frame of reference for time is given in the book itself, that's not totally unimportant, for the general background of Habakkuk is that God was raising up a nation, namely Chaldea, the Babylonians, and they were in the inceptive stages of international strength. They were about to make their impact on the international scene. Assyria had peaked as an international power, and Babylon now was the nation to be reckoned with. So that is in the background, and it is important, though it is not stated in the first two verses. Whereas the other prophets spoke to Israel and the nations about God, Habakkuk talks to the Lord about the problems of his nation. The problem which Habakkuk struggles with is, if there is a God, then why does evil exist? The question, who is responsible for wickedness, is pursued within the book. Habakkuk 1:3 reveals the writer's concern, and that is given in terms of these words, why dost thou make me see iniquity and cause me to look on wickedness? Yes, destruction and violence are before me, strife exists and contention arises. And simply what he's asking is, how does the Lord allow a completely decadent situation to continue to exist? You know why I ask that, don't you? That is so incompatible with his plan for Israel. That Israel had been designed by God to be a separate community, a nation that had been isolated from the other nations, marked off by her law and her relationship with Yahweh, with God. And that law was to be a reflection of that uniqueness. Now, there's nowhere it is commanded in the law that Israel was to go out as a missionary nation and that they would send out evangelists. However, the nation of Israel was designed in such a way as to draw attention to the universal rule of God and the particular rule of God over his people Israel. And by making their own relationship with God conspicuous, the nations would be attracted to the Lord himself. Now, you did not have to become an Israelite to be saved in the Old Testament. Don't think that way, that you were saved by faith, believing in God's provision of salvation. You did not have to become a Jew to be Christian. But what one would do in the Old Testament, you know, or in Israel, God had established Israel to be a reflection to the nations of his uniqueness, of his character, of his holiness, of man's sin. So those concepts were communicated, designed to be communicated through Israel. But Israel had become corrupt. She had abandoned the law. And as a result, she was a reproach to the nations. And you know, this is what the prophets would struggle with. This is what men like Daniel and Samuel and David really struggle with. That here they are having this unique relation with God, and what an embarrassment they were. No nation had that relationship with Yahweh like Israel. But look at them. They were an embarrassment. They were they stank, and yet they were to have been a fragrance. And so Habakkuk is struggling with that. Why did not God go on and do something about this? Why could not the situation be corrected so that Israel would not any further repulse others, and that the purposes of God could be carried out? How can a holy God tolerate the sin of his own people, Judah, is the question. Why is the divine solution to this problem, as is developed within, or what is the divine solution to this problem as it is developed within the book of Habakkuk? Also note that the prophet grapples with the problem of why the wicked Chaldeans were used to punish Judah, verses 12 through 17. How do the answers to these questions fit into the doctrine of personal suffering? I would like to respond to that with three principles, taking the third from our study in the book of Job, but tying these two books together. The question that is responded to in Habakkuk, and listen, it's a great book on this subject, that why do God's people and the wicked prosper? It's right in line with what Asaph struggled with in Psalm 53 and with the fact the problem that Job struggled with through his own experience. And Job, you recall, asked that question with regard to his own circumstances. He was not so much concerned about a national problem, but as he lost his own, lost his family, he lost his material wealth, he lost his wife, not physically he lost her, but at least he lost her loyalty and allegiance, and everything around him, from physical health to family to you name it. Job did end up with his own life. He had that. And Job struggles with this. Why? Why? And you can watch the struggle in his own soul, and it's revealed for us through the pages of Job. So Job struggles with it on a personal basis. Why is God allowing this to happen to me? Whereas in Habakkuk, Habakkuk is struggling with it. Why is God allowing this to happen to the nation? Why are these wicked conditions allowed to increase, and that many more people become blinded to their own spiritual needs? All right, let me give three principles. One, the silence of God must not be misinterpreted. The silence of God must not be misinterpreted. And that is part of God's answer to Habakkuk in chapter 1 and verse 5. Notice it. Behold, and here is the answer to his first question, why are you allowing sin to increase in our nation? What is our nation getting so off, so decadent? You know, that question can easily be asked of our own nation. Now, we are not a nation in the exact same sense that Israel was, in that we are not a covenant, we do not have a covenant relation with God. However, if this nation sends out the great missionary force throughout the world and is a real fortress for evangelism, if God is using this nation, has used it in such a way in history as to offset the powers of evil in totalitarian countries, and we do have a market for freedom, though that freedom may be diminished somewhat, yet we are symbolic of the Western world and its freedom. And a question could then be legitimately asked, why would God allow a nation like this just to completely falter, stumble, and then be absolutely useless? So the question, and God says, behold, ye among the nations, look and wonder marvelously, for I am working a work in your days which you will not believe, though it be told you. Here's the point. Don't misinterpret the silence of God. There is a rendezvous which God has with the nations, and God allows a nation to go in a direction for the purpose of standing before him ultimately in judgment. So there's the answer. That's the first principle. The silence of God must not be interpreted. The wicked will be judged. Now you wonder then, how will God do anything about our own conditions in our nation? Question was that Habakkuk asked, will you do anything about conditions in Judah? God's answer, I'm working on it. Don't you sweat it. That I have a rendezvous with the nations, and that there is judgment in time, and there is judgment in eternity. And that is his first word to Habakkuk. So don't misinterpret the silence of God. The righteous will not always suffer. For those who live by faith, as we'll see in chapter 2:4, and for the wicked who are apparently prospering, they will not always prosper. And it's really a misunderstanding what true prosperity is. You're rather short-sighted if you think that the wicked are ultimately prospering. The very fact that they are not immediately being wiped out does not mean that God is not preparing them for a time when they will be judged. So the justice of God says, first of all, and that is really that is the facet of God's character which is in view here. And I think Habakkuk has to be reminded of God's justice. And justice means that there is going to be, well, first of all, he's responding to it by saying there's going to be retribution. And that retribution is in time and eternity. So the apparent success of the nations in their hostility to God, Judah, for example, that God is going to work retribution in time as well as in eternity. In time for Judah, it will be the Chaldeans. But ultimately, everyone, all the wicked will have to stand before. All those who reject Christ will have to stand before God in judgment. So that's his first answer. There is judgment. However, at the same time, there is reward for God's people. So the reward, well, let's put it out here, balance it off. The reward is coming to God's people. The righteous will not always suffer. Now, there's reward in time. as well as reward in eternity. Same concepts, parallel concepts. And what he's going to say in chapter 2 and verse 4 is that this living by faith makes a difference in time as well as in eternity. The arrogant will be judged in time as well as in eternity. How are they judged in time? Well, they're judged by their own sin. As you know, that part of the sin of, or law of retribution, is that sin carries with it its own punishment. And that the fact that the wicked are prospering is a superficial analysis. Very superficial. And that is a... If you draw that conclusion on the basis of what you observe, you've drawn a wrong conclusion. The fact that you are suffering, and then you look around at 10 people that you think, and they may very well be, living a life that's in totally defiance of God, ignoring His will and plan. Why does God allow them to go their merry old way and have an increase on their dollar and enjoy a relatively good life, and yet here is someone, maybe even yourself, that you are going through many a deep water? And why is God allowing this to come your way? Well, you have to understand that you're making a superficial analysis if you think that they're prospering in the ultimate sense of the word. The prosperity begins in the heart. And part of the law of retribution is that sin will bring its judgment in time. It'll bring its own destruction. That is what was happening with Judah. They were bringing upon themselves their own destruction by their own behavior. So what all that glitters is not gold. And that the fact that a person may be on the surface of it enjoying the good life, while their soul may be eaten up with spiritual cancer, they may be on the surface of it enjoying life, but in their own soul they're sour on life. They're in a frantic search for some kind of security and happiness. So you see, that is really a superficial evaluation to begin with, that they're prospering, maybe monetarily, but there's more prosperity than monetary benefits, much more. So reward is ultimately for the believer in time. Well, we'll develop that when we look into 2:4. So that's part of the answer. Don't misinterpret the silence of God. God is just. He's doing right. So don't sweat it. God's doing the work. He's taking care of the situation. The second response is verse 4, chapter 2, that God allows suffering to test the faith of His children. God allows suffering to test the faith of His children. Why does God allow difficulty to come into the life of a believer? Pressures, persecution. He wants to strengthen the faith of those that He loves in a special way. He allows suffering to test the faith of His children. It's His desire to develop a better understanding of Himself and His ways. He wants to develop within you a better understanding of who He is and what He can do. That's why. So we've got to face this thing positively when we come into suffering. That's the key to this whole concept. That's why it brings up faith. That's a positive attitude toward God's plan, the faith principle. So here's the other side. There is retribution for the arrogant. There is reward for the righteous. And this reward for the righteous is in terms of time, living by faith, living. And that's a capital L, living. That doesn't mean that you just survive by faith. It means that you enjoy life and all that it's designed to be by faith. That is true prosperity. The eternity factor is that you will enjoy a reward of the Lord, and that He will. Well done, thou good and faithful servant. So the Lord will honor and will reward in time and in eternity. So God allows suffering to test the faith of His children, the love of God. So God's treatment of you is as a father to His child. And His treatment of the wicked is not on that basis at all. And He has ultimate objectives for you as a believer, which are totally different from the unbeliever. So don't expect Him to be dealing with you on the same basis as the unbeliever. Not at all. No more than you would deal with neighborhood children on the same basis that you deal with your own children. Is that you are ideally looking out for their welfare, their benefit. What you do for them is done for their benefit, out of love for them. God looks out for us from the source of love. So His dealings, therefore, are to bring us on to greater maturity in Christ, always. There's a third factor, and I'm going to import this from Job. It's really a reminder of what we studied, and you would review those, I'd hope, on page 89 in your Old Testament notes, that this also must be brought into the picture, and it's the existence and purposes of Satan. The existence and purposes of Satan also answer to the question, why do the godly suffer and why do the wicked prosper? that Satan is the adversary of God and his people. So you have an adversary which the unbeliever does not have. True. The message of Nahum is God. If God is against us, who can be for us? God is against the wicked. But you have to balance this off with that fact that Satan is against God's people. God is for his people. But there is a fact, there is in time then that which God allows under the jurisdiction of Satan. This is his world. So God allows us suffering so that we may learn the God-centered life and put off the self-centered life. That is what the time factor is in verse 4. Now I'm going to go on to the, I'm going to come back to 2:4 and develop that later, so there are just a few other things that can be said about it, but let's hold them until that time. Let's go now to the third principle on the study of Habakkuk. That is, study Habakkuk by identifying the five woes against the Chaldeans. Now, let me give you some context for these woes. They begin at verse 6. The Lord is responding to Habakkuk's question. What is he going to do about the Chaldeans? Or how can he use the Chaldeans who are wicked? Well, his answer is in to describe the wickedness of their state. And I think also that in these woes that he's describing the sins of Judah as well. So they are bound up with one another. It's not exclusive. These are not exclusively Chaldea's woes, but Judah's as well. One of Habakkuk's questions was, how could God use the wicked Chaldeans to punish Judah? 1:12. The answer is given in 2:4-19. What was the Lord's answer? Identify the five woes against the Chaldeans. In your answer, be sure to give the reason for this pronouncement of judgment. And I'd ask that you note the recurring phrase, because of men's blood, verses 8 and 17. To what extent can a section like this be applied to any nation? I've asked that question, I guess, 4 or 5 times through our study of the prophets, and I hope that it has made a great impression on your own soul that the prophets have a lot to say to a Gentile nation, though that's true. The bulk of the material in the prophets was delivered to Israel, a theocracy, covenant with a covenant relation to God. Yet, Gentile nations, a nation like the United States of America, is not independent of the standards of God. Because God does hold a nation like ours responsible for living compatibly, consistently with his moral law. Well, I'll come back to that, but I want to show you these five woes. Number one, it's in verses 6 through 8. The first is the woe because of plunder, blood, and violence. This is, here's another good, I say good in the sense of insightful, that it is a vivid description, a profile of a wicked nation, a nation that is decadent. And that's the first symptom of it in verses 6 through 8, because of their plunder, blood, and violence, 6 through 8. It says, shall not all these take up a parable against him, an atoning proverb against him, and say, woe, woe to him that increases that which is not his. How long? And that ladeth himself with pledges. The point that he makes here is that they rob the poor. It's interesting of the number of references in these five woes to financial violence. And I don't mean to use that word promiscuously. I think we have to use the dictionary form of the words if we're going to maintain any form of civilization. I don't mean to say that violence, that there is physical violence. This is perhaps a better way of stating it is that they were abusing the poor, and that there was graft and corruption financially. So they were, the pledges mentioned in verse 6. The pledges refers to taking advantage of others financially. And this is why I think he also is mentioning Judah as well as the Chaldeans. And that would have been especially a matter sensitive to the Judeans, to the Jews. For the Jews, they were not allowed to loan money to fellow Jews with interest. And I'm not trying to say that we should not loan money with interest today on a commercial basis. Commercial law today was not really covered under the Mosaic law. You simply cannot find a situation like the Abraham and Sons Finance Company under the Mosaic law. They didn't have that. If it were done, it was on a personal basis. And one Jew could come to another Jew for a loan. However, there are some things said under the law about, or regulations given to that, to regulate that situation. One is that if you're going to take collateral, that you'd better be sure that you give that collateral back if it happened to be their sleeping bag, in terms of their outer cloak. That if you're going to take collateral, you'd better be sure that it's not going to work a hardship on them. In other words, that you would not charge interest. And then also in Proverbs, we're studying this on Monday morning. We studied it last Monday morning. That the rule of thumb is don't cosign for somebody else going into a loan with somebody else. And those were some guidelines under the Mosaic Law. Well, what is said here about the pledges is that apparently in Chaldea they were using the finance, the whole area of finance, to rob people. And so a few were getting richer, you had the fat cats, but everybody else was getting poor. So that's the first point, that because of their plunder, their blood, their violence. The second, in verses 9 through 11, because of their pride and cruelty. Woe to him that getteth an evil gain for his house, that he may set his nest on high, that he may be delivered from the hand of evil. Because of pride and cruelty. The pride principle is... comes from the statement that sets his nest on high. What he does there is to take the analogy of an eagle or a vulture, which would build its nest up in the crag way up in the mountains, somewhere way away that you couldn't get to it, a place for security where they could feed their young and be protected. And so what he says by referring to the nest then is that the nest on high, in terms of human activity, is trying to find happiness and security, and in the context, through dishonest business, through dishonesty. So it is trying to find security and happiness through evil. You cannot do it. There will not be, you cannot find happiness and security in life apart from the Lord. So you see the soul prosperity that he talks about in 2:4. We have the negative side of it in this passage. That you cannot find the security of your own that you're looking for, protection for the future, by dishonest gains. The third woe is mentioned in verses 12 through 14 because of their general iniquity. He says, woe to him that buildeth a town with blood and establisheth a city by iniquity. Behold, is it not of Jehovah of hosts that the peoples labor for the fire and the nations weary themselves for vanity? This is a building boom that's going on. However, the building boom has been based on evil. It's been based upon graft, real estate corruption, payoffs, many of the things that exist in our own society. And I guess if the lid could be pulled off what actually goes on around City Hall and around a lot of the places of high finance, if the lid could be lifted, there'd be a lot of worms under that lid. And every once in a while, it's just moved off to the side a little bit. We get just a little sniff of the stench that's under there. And but this person, if they can afford a lawyer, they may get off lightly, or they may get off altogether. And so we just sort of cock our head a little bit and say, well, hey, now, I wonder if everything must be all right then if this is the only person that's doing this. The point is that probably he's just one of the less than 10% that's been caught. And then he's been able to minimize the own penalty in his own case because he had the money to get off lightly. But I submit to you that if the lid could be pulled off, it would be a can of worms that it would knock us back on our heels. Now, some of us know what's going on in housing and finance in this city in the last 10, 15 years on this side of town. People will come in and build houses, build apartments that do not meet the building code. They pay off inspectors. People, some of these people are members in fine standing boards. Some of them they're really big wheels in their church. But when they get out into their own business, when they get out into their own area of responsibility in life, they take money on the side, they take payoffs, they cut corners, and they ignore biblical ethics. So that just shows you that our own nation in many ways is comparable to the nation in Habakkuk's day. And if it's like that here, you can be sure that it's like that in other places. So the point then in verses 12 through 14 is because of this, their general iniquity. Building boom, but it's based on evil. You know, there's a lot of clucking at City Hall these days about Atlanta becoming an international city. I gag on that after a while. The press gets everybody just, oh, this is just the millennium. If we can become an international city. Well, if becoming an international city means becoming like New York, New York, or San Francisco, California, forget it. All what you're asking for, probably, without ethical restraints, what you're asking for is for more mafia activity. You're asking for more graft. And I've seen on news from time to time some of this, and what amazes me with these news segments that they have, whether it's the longshoremen, graft and among the dock workers, and turning their back while the gangsters will come in and take automobiles or refrigerators off the dock, sell them on the black market, the graft that's in the labor unions. And every once in a while, TV will have a little segment on that, but there's very little follow-up. You often wonder what's happening. It's turned over to some Senate subcommittee, and they're examining it. And you always wonder, what happens to this? Is that just the governmental way of sweeping dirt under the rug? I'd like to give them the benefit of the doubt, and I'm not denying the fact that there are probably men who really would like to do the right thing in government. And I'm sure many a man has gone to Congress and has gone into government, into politics, even gone as far as Washington, really wanting to do something. But I just get the impression that what they find is there's so much viciousness and evil that it blunts their own effectiveness, that they're so outnumbered and they're so intimidated that they're able in the long run perhaps to do very little. Well, that's the condition that exists in our own nation. So if becoming an international city means that we've got to legalize evil and sin to do it, then that is not prosperity. That's one of the woes. The fourth woe, verses 15 through 17, debauchery. Debauchery, if you like an interpretation of debauchery, just means leading others astray morally. It's sort of the Pied Piper concept. It's that which the influence that you bring on others, it's your own moral lack of morality is like a cancer, and it affects others. So, because of their sinful debauchery, 15 through 17, says, woe unto him that giveth his neighbor drink, to thee that addest thy venom, and makest him drunken also, that thou mayest look upon their nakedness. Two ways of taking this. Some take this as a literal statement that it is a curse to put the bottle to the mouth of another person who would deal in liquor and strong drink. That is a possible interpretation. However, I think that it's probably used in a figure of speech in view of what he's saying about looking on their own nakedness and the way it's used. A similar statement is used in Isaiah and Jeremiah. I think it's also in Ezekiel. Probably what he's speaking here of is the influence of their own moral corruption upon others. And that what he's saying by giving them to drink and making them drunk, it is that you are causing them to become drunk with your own moral evil. Now, of course, it would include the operating in the liquor industry. I think that would come under this curse. People who are active in the field of alcoholic beverages, I think, come under this woe of verse 15 by application, and that there is no virtue to alcohol. And there is, I think, unfortunately, among some Christians today, in the reaction against legalism of the past day, that in liberty some have thought that therefore alcohol is it's open season, and that you can get away with social drinking. That if you want to have a Bloody Mary from here to New York, it's all right. Your liberty allows you to do that. If you want to have a little something before a meal from time to time, that's all right. And I'll tell you this right quick, that alcohol, hard liquor, has perhaps been one of the most vicious evils that has ever blighted our nation. And in view of the viciousness of this evil and the problems that it has caused, for a Christian to flirt with something like that and set an example for others, I think probably is recklessness. At best, it's recklessness. And I'm fully aware of what the Bible says about alcohol and wine, and have studied again and again and again, and have personally seen what it's done to lives and know what it can do to a life. if you happen to be one of those that is playing a little reckless with your own liberty, I just warn you that you not only have to remember your own responsibilities or your own welfare, you may be able to occasionally drink a scotch and soda, and you may not be an alcoholic, you may not be a drunk, but you've got to remember that there are others who could very well be aware of your pattern of living and don't take into the fact that you are able to control yourself. Maybe they're totally uncontrolled. I would remind you of what Romans 14 says about a responsibility to others. I think that's the safe side of it. Frankly, I think the other is a bit reckless. Then the final woe that he mentions is because of their idolatry, chapter 2, verses 18 through 20. Cause of idolatry. Woe to him that saith to the wood, awake, to the dumb stone, arise. That's a bit of sarcasm on the part of Habakkuk. It reminds us of Elijah, doesn't it, on Mount Carmel. Well, a little louder, your God's probably asleep or he's gone on vacation. And he's describing the absolute spiritual stupidity of going after idols. Well, we may not bow down to something that is in the form of a Buddha. We may not bow down to something that's been etched out by the hands of someone else to represent some deity. But we may bow before other things. It may be automobiles. It may be a home. It may be a possession of some sort. It may be pleasure. It may be a romance. I know that there are those who've sold their soul to the Satan, as it were, because they have their eyes set on a certain one of the opposite sex. They're going to have them. They want them, regardless of what it does to them personally. That's a form of idolatry. Now, what is the application of all this to the nations? I think that it comes back to this basic principle that God does hold a Gentile nation in the times of the Gentiles. God does hold a nation responsible to his moral law. And we cannot, in this nation, say that we are totally independent of and not responsible to the moral law of God. That's one of the great dangers of a pluralistic society like ours, that the pluralistic society should not be construed to mean that we're not under obligations to God ultimately. Even the deists who established our Constitution, many of them were deists. They were not Christians, men like Jefferson and Franklin. That yet these men still lived under the concept of a Christian consensus. They made their decisions on the basis of an absolute, so unlike a lot of those who frame our own laws today. And I think one of the great dangers in our day, and Francis Schaeffer has done, I think, a tremendous job in analyzing this trend in our own culture. You would do well to read some of his works to see how he's analyzed this. And that is that we have come to the place in our own nation where we're in danger of the tyranny of legislation. And the tyranny that we face in this nation could not necessarily be through a dictatorship of one man, but it could be an executive dictator or an executive tyranny. It could be tyranny in terms of legislation. I think our Supreme Court is in danger of bringing that upon us. When decisions are made on the basis of the 51%, apart from, you see, that's all that you're left with if you abandon absolutes, biblical absolutes. What have you got in a pluralistic society? If you abandon biblical absolutes, what are your decisions going to be made on? The sociological 51%. This is what 51% want. This is what this is right. That rightness and wrongness is not determined by the 51%. Rightness and wrongness is determined by God's absolutes, and the nation that abandons God's absolutes bring their own destruction. We ought not to flinch or back away from that thing, that concept, in our own day, thinking, well, we'll allow everybody their own freedom. Let's understand the concept of freedom and that it requires responsibility ultimately to God. Let's hasten on to the fourth principle. Correction, bottom of page 178. There is a note about chapter 2, verse 14 that we ought to take into account. Take special note of 2:14, which I might add is... seems to be a quote reference to Isaiah 11:9, which is helpful in understanding its meaning here. In the midst of these woes, the prophet gives us a look at the future kingdom age. Why do you think he does this? Well, look at verse 14 in context. He says in verse 13, "Behold, is it not of Jehovah of hosts that the peoples labor for the fire and the nations weary themselves for vanity? For the earth shall be filled with the knowledge of the glory of Jehovah as the waters cover the sea." Well, that's right from Isaiah 11:9. What is he saying, therefore? The point, I think, that he's bringing up in the midst of the descriptions of the evil, he's saying that they will ultimately be eliminated. But how? How will they ultimately be eliminated? By judicial legislation? By the United Nations? By international law? The ultimate solution to the elimination of sin, the ultimate solution is Jesus Christ himself in the establishment of the kingdom. That is the ultimate solution. So the evils of the times of the Gentiles will be eliminated. And this is providing us with encouragement for the final outcome of history. The final outcome of history is an absolute. And though nations may deny the absolutes now, they will face the absolute in eternity in the future. That is the absoluteness of God's own justice and righteousness. And that is the vision of coming deliverance that's given in the midst of all these evils. So there is. We ought to be ultimately optimistic. So easy to become pessimistic, isn't it? You can just read the paper and you can get cynical after a while. Say, well, why even watch the news? Things are going from bad to worse. Cheer up, things get worse. You cheer up, things do get worse. So what you do in the midst of all that is not to become a pessimist and a cynic, but you remain an optimist. We really should. Ultimately, we should be optimistic about God's plan, what he's going to do. And he will ultimately eliminate evil. Now, that isn't to say we don't do anything about evil in the time being, but that is our ultimate view of history. Fourth principle, study Habakkuk by studying the use of Habakkuk in 2:4 in the New Testament. Study Habakkuk by studying the use of Habakkuk 2:4 in the New Testament. Now, I'm not going to be able to fully develop this in the time remaining, so I'm going to develop part of it, and then I want you to, if you haven't done this assignment, I really would like for you to do it, because this is, listen, Paul's quote of Habakkuk 2:4 in the New Testament does it three times. They're listed for you here, Romans 1:17, Galatians 3:11, and Hebrews 10:38. That is the very heart of Paul's theology. If you want to have the essence of Paul's theology, you have it right here in Habakkuk 2:4. So I want you to look at those passages in the New Testament and see what word from Habakkuk 2:4 is stressed. But I'd like to give you some context for that statement of 2:4. It begins in chapter 2 and verse 1. I will stand upon my watch and set me upon the tower and will look forth to see what he will speak with me and what I shall answer concerning my complaint. You know, this is Habakkuk's response to the answer of the Lord. Number one, I'm going to judge Judah. Number two, I'm going to use the Chaldeans. Habakkuk's question, how can you do it? Now, what the Lord tells Habakkuk is given in 2:4, that the righteous shall live by his faith. But I want you to note the context particularly of in 2:1. Here's the picture. In 2:1, he's describing the tower out in the midst of, say, a vineyard. You have this large vineyard, and in the midst of it, you have a tower that's set there, a symbol of solitude, just isolated from everything else. Of course, the tower was set there to look out and make sure that you don't have some black market operation trying to leech off your vineyard, somebody sort of like grape rustling, somebody come in here and load up and take all your grapes out, and or you may have some animals that will come in and decide to have their meal. So this tower was set out in the vineyard, or whatever crop was being grown. This tower was out here, and someone was stationed there, and it was a very lonely job, sentry duty. And the tower, though, is communicating the concept of solitude, getting alone. And what Habakkuk here is doing is the isolating. He's getting himself in a place of solitude for the Lord's answer to his questions. Let me give you this principle, I think. Very important principle on the response. Number one, learn to get alone with the Lord. Learn to get alone with the Lord. I think we probably need that lesson more than any other lesson, or at least any other generation needs that. There was a day when travel was not as easy. There was a day when you couldn't expect a phone call every few minutes. Didn't have phones. You stop and think how radically things have changed in the last 30 and 40 years. And you think of the things that really can be competitive to this aloneness and solitude. I am convinced that one of the great benefits that came to our forefathers, well, to my grandparents, their generation, was that there was time for solitude. and getting being alone with the Lord. Not just getting caught up so much in a schedule that you're just running around frantically. And we've got our children involved in sports. Mine is probably as well as many of yours. And the stores are convenient, so rather than go to the store once and have it over with, we may go to the store or this store, we can go to this shopping center. There's so many conveniences, so many things to do, and we get our schedules so that they're really tight. If we're not careful, we don't find the time to take time to be alone with the Lord. And I want to challenge you to learn to take time to be alone with the Lord. Now, you may not be able to go off to some mountain retreat, but it may mean take the phone off the hook. That may all it would take. Just pull that phone off the hook, and if some recorded voice tries to give you a message on that, just put him under the pillow and go on. But that may be what it takes. But that's very important. Number two is learn to study the Word for yourself, too. Learn to study the Word for yourself. Don't become totally dependent upon the public ministry of the Word. Don't be totally dependent on that. Learn to study the Word for yourself. I've said this before, and I'll say it again. Don't become totally dependent on a tape recorder or books. It's easy to do. Don't do that. If that's what your total source of spiritual intake is, if your sole source is all that you think getting alone is getting alone with a tape recorder, that's not really getting alone. Now, there's a place and a time for that, but you better learn to isolate yourself and do some thinking for yourself. Don't surrender your priesthood all the time. Don't surrender it at all. Three, learn to respond to your problems doctrinally. See, that's what Habakkuk's doing. He's responding to this problem doctrinally. He's getting himself alone with the Lord to allow the Lord to speak to him. Then he's going to be able to face this problem of suffering in his own life and his own nation and internationally. Let's pursue Habakkuk 2:4 next week. You're dismissed from this time period. Let's try to meet back at least by 4 of with some reasonable size.